Ситуация в Донецком аэропорту сегодня утром серьезно осложнилась. Сейчас там идут тяжелые бои.
В Донецке минувшей ночью жертвами обстрелов стали 5 человек.
Обстрел в Ленинском районе Донецка начался около 9 утра. СМИ сообщали, что
аэропорта Донецка осталась под контролем украинских военных.
Жертвами украинских авиаударов по Горловке стали...
Гибнут вооруженные люди с одной и с другой стороны.
В Донбассе ужесточается
обстрел. The battle between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists in Donbass is settling into a tense stalemate. But the real battle between Moscow and Kyiv is only just beginning. If 2014 was largely defined by the military conflict between Russia and Ukraine, now the coming year will likely be defined by a war of governance. In an editorial earlier this month, the Christian Science Monitor wrote that, quote, many nations wonder which governing model, autocratic or democratic, brings sustainable growth. With their overlapping history, culture, and religion, Russia and Ukraine offer a unique test as they cope with acute internal challenges. So let the games begin. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome, Natalia.
Hello.
And joining us on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via Skype from Bonn, Germany, is Andreas Umland, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kyiv Mohyla Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. Welcome back, Andreas. Good to see you.
Hello, Brian.
Well, as I said in the intro, a lot is riding on how Ukraine's reform process, both political and economic, turns out. The president and the government are at least rhetorically supporting reform, but not everybody agrees that they're sincere. The financier and philanthropist George Soros thinks they are and has argued that the West needs to provide a massive $50 billion Marshall-style aid package. But Bloomberg's Leonid Bershitsky wrote in a recent commentary that the government has, quote, dragged its feet on reform and taken a gradualist approach to needed change. And the investigative journalist turned parliamentarian Sergei Leschenko wrote recently that Ukraine is dominated by two political monopolies, one headed by President Poroshenko, the other by Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and a third clan led by billionaire Igor Kolomoisky. Natalia, let's start with you. How's the reform process going in Ukraine really? How committed are the authorities really to reform? And have we seen a sea change since Poroshenko's come to power, or are the oligarchs still really running the show? What do you see happening right now?
Well, I think it would be a bit idealistic to expect a sea change from the people who have been in power in Ukraine for the last 20 years in different capacities. Both President Poroshenko and Prime Minister Yatsenyuk and all of the oligarchs, one of whom you mentioned already. But I think it's really a bit absurd to call it political monopolies, because if you have three people already,
that's not a monopoly anymore.
That's not a monopoly. It's not even an oligopoly anymore. And I think what they started was it's a very difficult start. It's something that no one in the Ukrainian government or in the Ukrainian any Ukrainian authorities have tried to do before. They have a real start for the real market and democratic reforms in the country, and the previous parliament has adopted almost last minute the laws to put in place the anti-corruption laws, very important things, but these have not been implemented. So there could be different reasons for that. One of them is that you can say that they didn't want it, and many people in the Ukrainian civil societies and among the experts say that they didn't really want it because they want to be able to do the deals the way they were able to do the deals all those years before, and the way how they let go the people from the old regime, let them sell the assets in Ukraine, let them transfer the money and things things like that, not arrest the money. So you can say that, you can argue that they are really not serious about it, but on the other hand, they may say that these are serious reforms. We need to seriously prepare them to implement them. Mm-hmm. And also, you can't say that these three people or whoever the people are in on top are controlling the situation, because the situation is very volatile. And there is a lot of pressure from within Ukraine, from the civil society, and also from the donors, from the people who are going to support these reforms with their money.
Yeah. Would you say, I mean, from what you said, it seems to me you're saying the problem isn't one of legislation right now, it's one of execution.
Yeah, it's one of the actually preparing the reform plans. They have already invited the people from outside of the country, so the people that they were headhunting from Lithuania to Georgia and
the United States.
Exactly. Well, she's been living, if you mean Natalia Resko, she has been living in Ukraine for 20 years. But yes, still, she's American-trained economist, and she knows how to talk to the IMF and people like that. So it's really, you may say that it's still they still need the time to get it started. But after some time, people will start asking questions. They already ask questions. Mm-hmm. Why are you dragging on the mm-hmm. reforms? When are you going to start?
Is Leschenko's criticism fair?
I think it is fair. I think it's we could have seen much faster progress, at least what we could have seen, a much better communication with the public. Mm. That we can't do this, we plan to do this, we can't do this because of that, and this is what we're going mm-hmm. to do. Because mm-hmm. President Poroshenko has been criticized in Ukraine that he's a much better speaker in all international forums and between the heads of states, and he much less talks to his own people mm. and much less explains what he is doing or his government is doing.
What do you think, what is job number one? Like, what needs to be done, and what other than communication needs to be done better?
Well, the most important reform in Ukraine, and probably everyone agrees about it, is the judicial reform, because you can't do anything without the independent judicial. And that is still lagging from before the Yanukovych mm-hmm. times. And these people are still there. Mm-hmm. They still arrest the wrong people and let away the right people.
Right. Andreas, now you're in Bonn right now, but I know you of course live and work in Kyiv. What are your thoughts on these issues?
I largely agree with Natalia. I would be slightly more optimistic, because I think what we've seen during the last year in Ukraine is something like a beginning social revolution. That means a change that is actually changing deeply society, the state, politics, and even the culture of Ukrainians. And that's why I think there will be now a lot of pressure for reforms. There will be also a lot of resistance from the oligarchs, from corrupt officials against the implementation of reforms and the legislation. There are now civil society representatives in the parliament, not only Leschenko, but also others, who are deeply involved in the Euromaidan. The European Union is now a participant of Ukrainian domestic politics since the signing of the association agreement. And in general, the public mood has become much less complacent and much less ready to wait for reforms. Mm-hmm. And so I'm slightly more optimistic here, although I think it will be a long and hard fight against the old interests.
Yeah, we're coming back to this theme. And Natalia, I know we come back to this again and again and again. Civil society in Ukraine is so far, like light years ahead of the political establishment. And we're all waiting for the political establishment to catch up to what is a very advanced civil society right now. Andreas, would you agree with Natalia's contention that judicial reform is job one?
Yes, I would even say somewhat wider, that it's not just judicial reform, but the state apparatus in general, also the ministries, the departments have to be reformed and probably have to be reduced. The number of officials has to be reduced. Their salaries have to increase. and so that corruption will be not perhaps exterminated fully, but will be significantly less, not only in the judicial apparatus, but also in the executive.
Mm. Well, Kirill, let's take a look at this from the Moscow angle now. I mean, the Russian government this week unveiled a $21 billion anti-crisis economic plan that, as far as I can tell, involves little more than tapping the National Wealth Fund to inject some stimulus into the economy. It doesn't do anything to attack the structural problems in the Russian economy, and there isn't and won't be any talk of structural reform in Russia or any kind of reform in Russia under the current regime, as far as I can see. Russia's strategy appears to be to stick with its authoritarian state capitalist model and hope against all hope that oil prices go back up. That's like me wishing that my hair will grow back right now, but nevertheless, that does appear to be their strategy. But one part of Moscow's strategy is very, very, very clear. Do everything possible to prevent Ukraine's experiment with reform from succeeding. That seems to be Moscow's strategy right now because, and we're going to get into this a little bit later, the Ukraine succeeding could be a little bit dangerous for these folks. Would you agree that this is Moscow's strategy? Just make sure Ukraine doesn't, we're not going to reform, but let's just make damn sure Ukraine doesn't succeed in doing so.
First of all, it's quite funny for me to speak from Moscow angle. Yeah?
Well, no, you're not representing Moscow. You're interpreting the motivations.
Yes,
of this.
Yes, I'm trying. Yeah, to this, interpreting the things which you know couldn't be interpreted actually. First of all, when we look at the attempts of Kremlin now to deal with the economic crisis in the country, they try to do the same as they did in 2008. And in some sense, the same which the things which European governments did during the crisis in 2008 to bury the economic problems under a huge amount of money.
And in some cases, that works. Quite frankly, it did work in the U.S. and Europe. When you have a stable economy with the macroeconomic foundation is solid, you respond to a recession with stimulus. That's Keynesian economics. That's sound. But in 2008, the oil price fall was temporary. It was temporary because it was a result of the 2008 economic crisis. Right now, the oil is falling for structural reasons. It's not cyclical. It's structural.
That's why I'm trying to, to switch our attention from the very measures to the very structure of mm-hmm. this economy and the very structure of the society and the state. Because on some theoretical level, I'm not an economist, of course, but anyway, trying to bury these problems under cheap money is absolutely opposite the things which Putin did during the several first years of 2000s. Mm-hmm. Because what is Putinism? Putinism is a combination of authoritarian regime, political control, and neoliberal economy. Mm-hmm. Recent measures which they are trying to implement, it's an attempt to switch from neoliberal to Keynesian economy.
And you can't switch to Keynesian unless your fundamentals are solid, and Russia's fundamentals aren't solid. It's energy dependent.
Absolutely, because Keynesian economy could be, successful when you have, country, state system like, the United States in 1930s during New Deal reforms and so on, but not contemporary or recent Russia. Secondly, it's quite interesting how this new Keynesian model will or would combine with, all this Putin cronies who are, natural.
Well, this is what I mean about the fundamentals of the economy, because the stimulus just becomes another excuse for theft.
Thirdly, how it could combine with, the serious, in some sense, professional ideas of such people like Kudrin and so on, who are, the only professionals in the Putin circle, but all of them, they're neoliberals. Yeah. The only representative of so-called state, Keynesian, whatever, you can call it, however, economy is Glazyev, but he's not professional.
And I would not denigrate Keynes by calling Glazyev a Keynesian.
But
Kirill, I agree. I mean, what they're doing is, I don't expect it to work. And I don't expect to see any serious reform. But what about the part that Russia's basic strategy right now is to make sure Ukraine doesn't succeed. That is all I see, really. I don't see any serious attempt to deal with the economy. They're praying for oil prices to go back up, and that's it.
I think there are two levels. One level is, you know, a sort of public interest or state interest in Russia. Of course, from this perspective, of course, Russian government or, you know, authorities, they must implement a series, you know, structural, economic and social and political reforms. But the group which are now in Kremlin and so on, they are not interested in real things. They're interested in propaganda, in the influence on its own population, and so on. In this case, of course, and in this context, we can say that the only task or aim of Putin and his government and so on is to undermine the all Ukrainian attempts to, you know, to make reforms. But it's a very important thing. Let's return to the very beginning of our conversation and discussion. It's a delusion, and it's a well-known delusion, that there is a very strong connection between market economy and democratic society.
No, there is. There isn't a connection. I don't think there's a strong connection.
And that is very important. If someone in Ukraine thinks that market economy will bring automatically democratic state or so on, it's just a very...
But I think Ukraine is moving on both fronts, actually. I mean, as the historian Timothy Snyder said in a recent lecture, that Ukraine had... And I want to talk about this a little bit today because I think it's very interesting how Ukraine's the road not taken by Russia. Ukraine already had kind of an elite pluralism going, and they were trying to turn it into – they had an oligarchic pluralism, I believe is the phrase Professor Snyder used, and they're trying to turn it into a real pluralism. Russia didn't have the former. They didn't have the – well, they had the oligarchic pluralism under Yeltsin, but under Putin, they certainly didn't have the oligarchic pluralism. Ukraine's moving on both fronts. I don't think they're proceeding from the assumption that if we reform the economy, that's going to magically bring democracy. I think they are attempting haltingly in by – you know, but with various estimations of success on both fronts trying to move it forward. So I don't think they're making that mistake.
Believing that one doesn't work without the other.
Yeah, yeah. There, one doesn't lead to the other, but they work most efficiently together, for sure. But continue, Kirill, I'm sorry.
My idea is that, you know, all these measures and all this new Marshall Plan, which George Soros was speaking about and so on, it's all about, you know, neoliberal style of market economy. So I'm not sure that...
Not necessarily. The Marshall Plan came in, and that was basically in Keynesian times, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Both in U.S. and Europe.
Yes, I'm speaking about the new Marshall, and I'm speaking about the regulations and very strict rules, which in this context will provide a proper, in commas, a proper mechanism of economy, which is not true, especially after the crisis, economic crisis of 2008 until now. So now we don't live in the, you know, times of pure neoliberal economy, which is, you know, quite outdated. Idea that we are, you know, bringing neoliberal economy and everything will be, you know.
Well, look, all these terms are just ideal times. We never live in a pure Keynesian economy. We never live in a pure neoliberal economy. You always have elements of state intervention, even in the most liberal of times, and you always have elements of free market in statist times. One thing I wanted to turn to on Ukraine, and for get Natalia and Andreas on this, is something that I've been thinking about this a lot, and I don't have an answer. I mean, is it easy? I mean, we've been hearing about Ukraine trying to adopt reforms since back to the Yushchenko time, and unsuccessfully or haltingly. Is it easier for Ukraine to enact reform now due to the patriotism and the sense of unity that's come out of the conflict? Does that make it easier for the authorities to push these reforms that, let's face it, are going to be painful for your average Ukrainian? Or does the hardship of the war and the stress of the war make it harder for them to push this now? I don't know. There's not really an answer, but I want to hear what you both have to say about this.
There are several things here. The interplay of several factors, of course. First, at the Yushchenko times, Ukraine didn't have any plan for reforms. Now Ukraine is not choosing between the neoclassical, Keynesian, or any other model. It has a reform plan based on the association agreement and free trade agreement with the European Union. So there is no choice in that. And the third thing, which will make it very difficult for the Ukrainian government to have any meaningful reform, is that none of the political parties which came to the parliament this time talked about the what kind of reform Ukraine needs. And these kind of these reforms will be very difficult. And none of them has the had it in their platform, and none of them has the support of the population for that kind of reform. Mm-hmm. They had a general support of the population, but not for the specifics, for the things that they would really have to do.
And this is potentially dangerous because there's a social consensus for reform, for sure. But nobody really has a mandate to cut subsidies on home heating fees or anything like that. Exactly. Nobody had the political courage to stand up and say, "I am going to raise your tariffs on your home heating or whatever."
Right.
Food prices are going to go up, but it's going to get better later. But you have to trust us through this. Nobody really has a mandate for anything specific, and that you think that makes it more difficult.
I think it makes it more difficult because people expect them to magically change things, right, and how this is going to influence the Ukrainian family, especially Ukrainian families which were resettled because of the war and things like that. No plan has been done for that. And even for these people, for the internally displaced people, and for there is no agency that takes care of them. So everything that Ukrainians, every problem that Ukrainian society is now facing, works like that the volunteers move in, that they start working, and then they start negotiating with the government how the government can support the civil society in doing things.
Well, what role can civil society play here, really? Because you say nobody really had the political courage to stand up and say, you know, I'm going to raise your gas bill. But are there enough people in civil society that realize that, and that civil society could kind of carry a lot of the ball here?
Well, the experts are talking about it. The of course they go on the TV and talk about these things, but no politicians with the real political power is talking about this, which is a problem. And also the biggest ally of the Ukrainian civil society is of course the international donors, the people who are going to finance those reforms, because they say don't give the money before you see any serious attempt of reform, because otherwise the money is going to be wasted.
Andreas, what do you think? Is it easier or harder to enact reform now, given the situation Ukraine's in?
Well, the war is certainly a distraction, and it draws away attention and money and energy. But on the other, it also, I think it creates a sense of urgency, and it pressures also towards the reforms, and there's a consensus in Ukraine now that in a way the path to win the war is to enact as quickly and as possibly, as deeply as possibly, reforms in order to then create an attractive system in Ukraine, which would then attract back the Crimeans and the separatists in the Donbas. So I'm also also again a little bit more optimistic than Natalia here, because I think that the Ukrainians, they have gone already through hard times in the 1990s. I think Ukraine had one of the deepest economic crises that a European nation had in modern times, and then Ukraine was also heavily hit by the 2008-2009 world financial crisis. So I think they are, in a way, already used to this sort of situation. And if there's now a promise that all of this will then maybe actually lead to EU membership at the end of a very long road, then I think the endurance and the patience will be high. And as long as the reforms make sense and they are consistent and people see corruption falling, I think they will be ready to bear these deep reforms.
So you're more optimistic than Natalia that the Ukrainians are prepared to deal with the short-term pain. I mean, what about that? I mean, the Ukrainians did go through hard times in the 90s when there really wasn't this bright future at the end of the tunnel. It was, nobody knew it. I lived in Ukraine in the 90s and remember this. No, people didn't know it was at the end of the tunnel. And it was just, and the inflation was mind-blowing. I remember, you know, what, your water being shut off, your hot water being shut off regularly, electricity outage. There were all sorts of problems. People lived through that. Why not now with actually something at the end of the tunnel to look forward to?
Well, they didn't have very high expectations from their leadership in the first place. So I think that is one of the reasons. Another reason is that now people are more used to these hardships. They know what's happening, but it's the combined effect of worsening living conditions, the war, and also the lack of communication with the government and being in the same conditions in the state apparatus, the corruption and all of that kind of things. People want to see changes faster. They say, well, we've been to Maidan, we've been through the war. What is it going to bring us and when?
Now, there's something else I wanted to touch on here, and this is, I've always thought of, especially recently, thought of Ukraine as the road not taken in Russia. I remember the summer of 94 when the first post-Soviet Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, lost an election to Leonid Kuchma and amazingly stepped aside and let Mr. Kuchma come to power. And I thought at the time, wow, that's the first time that's happened in the post-Soviet space. I mean, it was not too many years into the post-Soviet space, and it was three years in. And you had a power changed hands and almost nobody noticed. I mean, it was pretty calm for an election. I remember Kyiv that summer. This, of course, never happened in Russia. If Ukraine is successful now, how dangerous? Because Ukraine has taken this different road from Russia. It went along this road of kind of elite oligarchic. Again, Kuchma and Kravchuk were both members of the elite. They were both part of the party of power. Maybe that made it easier for power to switch hands so easily then. But now Ukraine's pretty far down this road and is diverging from Russia radically. We always say that, and I've always thought that Ukraine succeeding is an existential threat for the Putin regime. I wonder if that's a little bit overstating it. Kirill, what do you think? How dangerous is a successful Ukraine for the Kremlin, for this Kremlin?
For this Kremlin,
is it a mortal threat? Because it'll set this precedent that in a culturally similar nation, you can have a functioning democracy and a functioning market economy, and they can go to Europe and the world doesn't end. And the Russians could start saying, hey, we can do that. Why are we worse than the Ukrainians? That's the conventional wisdom, right? Is that overstated, or could Russia just continue being Russia next to a completely democratic and European Ukraine?
I think it's not a role model. It couldn't be a role model for Russian people till the end of the times when everything Russian population, or the most part of Russian population, wants to know about the outside world. They see at Vesti 24, or, you know, spoke by Dmitry Kiselyov. If Dmitry Kiselyov would speak about, you know, the ruins of Ukraine, even, you know, Ukraine will be on economically on the level of, you know, Germany and so on, 90% of TV audience will trust him. So it's not a question of a real example of Ukrainian success. It's the question of political regime, political system in Russia, and it's the question about who's controlling media and so on. I'm very sorry, but it's so.
I think this works when you're talking about a faraway place like the U.S. or whatever. But I don't think this works with Ukraine. Russians know Ukrainians too well.
With the friends and families living in both countries.
There's so many intermarriages. The two countries are so close. We're not talking about telling some lie about what's going on in the U.K. or something.
Right, and I think it's also the level of hysteria that you see now in the Russian television cannot be sustained forever. So at some point they will have to come down and show some other things and get back to their internal problems, and the people will see the real situation.
Yeah, no, as Peter Pomerantsev is fond of pointing out, where they have it right now is a little bit too hot for the Putin system. The Putin system relies on passive acquiescence, not constant full-time bombardment of mobilization. So I tend to agree with that. But that said, even if people do know that Ukraine's succeeding, is that a mortal threat to Natalia? What do you think? Is it a mortal threat to this Kremlin? This Kremlin, not Russia as a nation, this ruling elite.
You know, I think that the real divergence of the Ukrainian and Russian ways started in the summer of 2013, when most of the Ukrainian business elite decided to support the European Association Agreement and Free Trade Agreement. And I think that was not only because they thought that they will be better off in the new system, but also because they saw the attack on the Russian business in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a very important signal for them, that if they become part of that Russia-dominated space, they would have the same problems as their Russian counterparts.
Turn into Hutterkovskys.
Yeah, well, not even on that level. I think it's even on a much lower level, on the level of middle class and the level of small and middle-sized companies. And we see that in Crimea now, that all those small business, middle-sized business, they all go out of business because they cannot work in the Russian conditions.
Right. No, I agree with you that the summer 2013 was the decisive break. I see Ukraine and Russia kind of going along different paths, but for Russia's purpose, Ukraine was still close enough to control. But then by the summer of 2013, they had to make a decision one way or the other. We're going to go the Russian route, or we're going to go the European route. The oligarchs made their call, and I do think that was the decisive moment. Because then you had the oligarchs and the civil society on the same side, and no regime can really beat that. Andreas, what are your thoughts? You're a Russia watcher as well. Do you see this as a mortal threat to the Kremlin?
I agree with Kirill that now I think the public opinion and public atmosphere in Russia is now spoiled to a degree, and that I don't think that for large parts of the population Ukraine could play the role of a role model. But for the sort of elite in Moscow, by elite I mean not just the ruling elite, but the intellectuals, the oligarchs, the entrepreneurs, the officials, and so on. If they in 2, 3, 4, 5 years see that Ukraine is doing maybe even not as good yet as Russia, but is doing relatively well without having as many resources, as many oil and gas, and that Ukraine has actually some sort of future within Europe, within the European Union, that the association agreement is working, or starting at least to work. I think that then when there comes a new stage in Russian development, either a new presidential election like in 2018, or some destabilization of the political regime, then I think in such a critical situation, in such a division, when you have to choose a new leader, a new path, then the Ukrainian model actually could play some role. And maybe the association agreement that Ukraine has signed with the EU now could then be something that at least parts of the Russian intellectual elite and the political leaders may see as the path to go for Russia as well. But for that, of course, first of all, the current system would have to discredit itself even further than it is discredited now. And I think the worse the situation in Russia gets, the less legitimate will the Putin system be. And then if things go well in Ukraine, indeed, there could be political analysts, even in the Kremlin, who say, well, maybe that's for us the way to go. It also depends, of course, on China and on the Islamic states, how they will develop, a lot of factors. But I do think that the future Ukraine could be a model.
So some future Kremlin advisor will say we need the Ukrainska variant. That would be something. But Andreas, I think you did hit it on the head here, because the model is going to appeal to the elite. Just as Natalia said, the key moment in Ukraine was the summer of 2013 when the oligarchs said, whoa, we don't want to go this Russian way. Let's go the European way, legitimize our wealth and be safe. I think you might begin to see the same kind of sentiments operating inside the Russian elite down the road. And this, I believe, is actually where the Ukrainian model could be deadly for the Putin regime. There was a fascinating piece in Bloomberg today. I don't know if any of you saw it, about Putin's shrinking inner circle. And it's shrunk down to just a few Siloviki now, according to the reporting that Bloomberg has done. And that larger part, the broader elites, the majority are urging Putin to just get out of the Ukraine crisis, find a settlement, get out. We have to fix things at home. And he's not listening. He's kind of cloistered himself with this very small group of Siloviki, people like Patrushev and Ivanov. And that's who he's listening to right now. And he's not listening to the economic wing of the elite, who are all urging him to end this crisis. You have to wonder, at some point, Putin's going to become a complete liability to this part of the elite. And you have to wonder if that's going to be the end. Kirill, last word to you before we move on to the next segment.
Just a few words about the very nature of this model. I wonder what kind of model, Ukrainian model, would be interesting for Russia. Because now there are very rare examples of a real interesting and successful reforms during a wartime. I think maybe in European history, the modern European history, the only one is reforms in the First Republic during the revolutionary wars in the end of 18th century and during the First Empire, during the Napoleon. And that's all. In this case, if Ukraine, actually wants to, or Ukrainian elite actually wants to push successful reforms, they need to add social consensus to national and patriotic consensus. Mm-hmm. And that is a crucial thing. And that's why I'm not sure about the ability of neoliberal reforms to support this social consensus. Mm-hmm. And that's the very important thing, not just for Ukraine, and it's very important for Russia. I don't know if you saw a very interesting speech by a legendary, so-called legendary farmer from Urals, Vasily Melnichenko, yesterday, who was attacking Putin on all the fronts, from economy to foreign relations and so on, Ukraine especially. And previously he was quite, he was a supporter of Putin, but he is not neoliberal. He is, socialist. He is, in some sense, an old-fashioned communist. So the question is how to reach this social consensus, both in Ukraine and in Russia.
I mean, as far as the Ukrainian, the model, you could get away from the neoliberal candidate. What I see are three possibilities for Ukraine, honestly. I've actually thought about this. In a successful scenario, I see three possible, from best to okay to worst of the best. In the best case scenario, Ukraine becomes like Poland, basically. In the worst case scenario of success, it becomes like Bulgaria, a functioning Western market economy with its problems. In the middle scenario, it becomes Slovakia. Those are the three kind of things I can see. Now that's not based on anything scientific. It's just me, thinking about it. But that's where I think we're going to be. But any of those three would be a good outcome for Ukraine. And on that note, we'll switch on to the second segment. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the situation in Donbass and explore whether Kyiv is really actually preparing to cede separatist-held territories. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining us on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us via Skype from Bonn, Germany is Andreas Umland, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kyiv Mihaila Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сегодня я могу сказать, что мы по всей линии фронта.
Мы потрясены очередным чудовищным преступлением.
Российские террористы.
Россия уменьшила свою военную присутствие на.
Нынешняя эскалация ситуации на Донбассе не случайна. В течение
всего. Мы являемся свидетелями резкого обострения ситуации на юго-востоке.
Мы не отдамо ни клаптика украинской земли.
Let's look at a few facts. Russia and Ukraine have agreed to a demarcation line in the conflict in the Donbass that basically corresponds to the current military reality. Ukrainian forces have abandoned the Donetsk airport, that symbol that they had fiercely defended for Moscow-backed separatists for months, and which a Ukrainian newspaper this week dubbed our Stalingrad. And there were reports earlier this week that the Kyiv agreed to allow top representatives of the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics to participate in peace talks should they resume. I'm not sure if that about that third, but there were reports about that. I haven't seen confirmation on that. But when I look at these things, I can't help but ask, is Ukraine de facto ceding these territories? Even if they'll never, ever say it in public. And I don't want to debate whether this is good or bad. We've done that this year. But it seems to me that they might be, that this might be something that they don't dare say it out loud, but it seems to me that they are. Natalia?
First of all, we need to have in mind what territories we're talking about, because since the start of the anti-terrorist operation, as Kyiv calls it, the territory which the DNR and LNR, or those two entities, have been controlling, was reduced twice. Mm-hmm. And now they are trying to gain back to where they were before, and the head of the LNR, the DNR, Zakharchenko, the leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, he said that they want to occupy the territory of the whole oblast, of the whole Donetsk oblast. Now, if Kyiv, if we see this in the way that Kyiv wants to secede and to let them get into the territory, to occupy these territories, we don't know where they're going to stop. And what we have seen so far is that the commanders in the front in the Ukrainian military, they say that the Russian side, because they don't really see many of the local people in the troops, among the troops of the DNR and LNR, they say that what the Russian army is using this time of truce for mounting the forces, for making another attack, for gaining a little bit more of the territory, and then again there is another truce, another attack, another a little bit gaining of the territory. So how far they're going to move until they're being stopped by the serious counter-attacks of the Ukrainian army, we still don't know. And we also see that there are the reports by the Ukrainian authorities, also confirmed by the NATO experts, that there are about 9,000 Russian troops on the territory of both these entities. So how far they can go is one question. And if Kyiv allows them to do that strategically, what does it gain from it? Mm-hmm. Does it gain what it wants? And basically what it wants is to close the border and for Russia to withdraw its troops. And I don't see any way how they can reach this by seceding the territory.
You think Russia will continue to push as far as they can, all the way to Kyiv, or?
No. I'm saying that that Kyiv will have to answer in a more serious way to these advances of the Russian army, and the question is where they're going to do that, and how these negotiations are going to look like after that, because what has been agreed in Minsk has not been implemented. implemented at all. On the Russian side, of course. And that is the question. If they're going to have another negotiations, are they going to sit down and talk and sign a paper which they know in advance that is not going to be implemented at all?
I mean, what I was thinking is when this demarcation line was set, the first thing that popped into my head is I predict, and I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I predict that this is going to be the future border of Ukraine on the eastern side. That was my feeling when they agreed to this demarcation line.
Well, you know, it's one thing that there are analysts who say that seizing Donbass would be a good thing for Ukraine, yeah, because then they will put the responsibility, the liability of this region on Russia and forget about it. But on the other hand, the Ukrainian population is very much against it. They want the Donbass back. They want the Crimea back. And there are reasons to do that, of course, too. So, and it's also the primary problem is the ability of President Putin to sign an agreement and abide to it, and that is the main thing.
I would say it's the ability, it's the willingness, for sure. But I think there's a third option, Natalia, and that's that. I mean, you know, freeze this and live to fight another day, and you fight a different way, the way we were talking about in the first half of the podcast, making a strong, stable European Ukrainian state that these territories are going to want to come back to.
Why are you going to freeze it? How are you going to freeze it? That's the question. Because whenever you freeze it, you see that what the other side is doing.
Mm.
So it's not a permanent freeze. There is no, and there were, I don't see how this could be a permanent freeze. I think if there was a permanent freeze, I think Kyiv would actually accept it.
Yeah.
But there is no guarantee that this is going to
be a permanent freeze. Yeah, yeah. But do you think they're thinking in those terms right now? Because I certainly do.
It's really hard to say, but I think it's very tempting for them to do that because also because when you start to put the budget, when you start to think about what you need to do with the country, plus that, all the money that you need for the reconstruction of Donbass, you're better off not to think about it.
You're going
to
need two Marshall Plans to do that. Andreas, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think there are two situations. If the current these so-called People Republics stay in the current borders, that is one situation. But if, as Zakharchenko has just announced, he wants to go further beyond the current borders, that will be a completely different situation and a huge escalation, not only in Ukraine but also in the relations between Russia and the West. And one could even imagine then new sanctions from the West. I think that maybe at the current situation for Ukraine, the best that it can achieve is actually a freezing of the situation and the ability to concentrate on domestic reforms, because Ukraine simply does not have the resources to fight a full-scale war against Russia. And the West can maybe exert more pressure, more economic pressure, but if Russia is sort of taking the current sanctions, and if it's sort of not sufficiently interested to get rid of the current sanctions, there's very little that Ukraine can do, and the West, as it looks now, will not impose new sanctions unless there will be a new.
If there's a further escalation by Russia, I actually think they will.
Yes, but yes, that's a different situation then, and I think that would be then for Russia enormously costly, an offensive war, let's say, going back to Slavyansk or even to Mariupol, as Zakharchenko has announced, will be costly because the Ukrainian army is in much better shape now than in summer. And also because the West, I think, will not tolerate that and impose new sanctions. And I think there are lots of sort of thoughts of this already there about financial sanctions, maybe even import sanctions on Russian oil. So that will be enormously costly for Russia. I cannot imagine them doing this at the already currently so complicated economic situation. So. But there is, of course, for Poroshenko, I think there's an enormous problem that that the fighters in the east, they want actually to fight and they want to return the Ukrainian territory to the Ukrainian state. There's also a large part of the elite and of the population that wants the army to do its job and to get out the invaders as they see it. Maybe from an economic viewpoint, getting back Donbass at the current situation is sure. simply impossible because this region is now, as it seems, totally destroyed. It would be a huge liability for Ukraine to build up this region, and therefore the freezing may be actually now the best of the bad choices that Ukraine has.
No, and I tend to agree with you, with both of you, the prospect of freezing this has to be very alluring to President Poroshenko, but it's also going to be the Kremlin's worst nightmare because the Kremlin doesn't want this. The Kremlin doesn't want an Abkhazia and Donbass. They don't. This isn't really a tasty chunk of territory like Abkhazia is. But more importantly, their ability to meddle in Ukraine's affairs is a lot higher with Donbass in it than with Donbass not in it. Let's face it. So I don't think Moscow wants this. Then the mantra from the Kremlin is we want to preserve the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And everybody laughs, but I believe them. I believe them because they certainly did. I think that's the worst thing that could happen to Russia is for this conflict to be frozen. Kirill, I wanted to turn to you on this because I'm still trying to figure this out myself too. I mean, we don't hear the words Novorossiya anymore as much as we used to. We used to hear this all the time in Russian media. You know, this strip of this mythical little piece of land that runs from what Kharkiv in the north to Odessa in the south.
It's not a small piece of land. It's about half of the country.
It's a crescent-shaped kind
right,
of...
Bigger than a normal-sized European country. Yeah.
But we don't hear this talk of this bit anymore. And you got to wonder, is this whole thing dead? Or does Russia still harbor, does Putin, in the small crew of Siloviki, you really can't talk of a deep state anymore or of a Putin Politburo anymore. It's like a mini Politburo. Now, the few people he's talking to, are they still dreaming about Novorossiya, or have they given up on this?
I'm not a military expert, and moreover, I'm not an expert in psychology, I'm not going to...
But you pay close attention to Russian affairs. What's
yes,
your take?
Yes. And my answer could be, a series of quotation from 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
I knew you were going to say something like this.
Yes, I'm not sure that now Putin's thoughts are, it's really different from from several characters from this novel. But first of all, I don't believe in the very idea of some semi-independent Donetsk or Donetsk and Lugansk region, because when we're speaking about the demarcation line, how could you imagine a semi-independent or even independent, not state, but territory, whose border, just crosses the city, like in Donetsk? It's impossible. We are not in Berlin.
Happened in Berlin.
In the beginning of... So that is the core of the problem. And I think the solution of this problem is military. I'm very sorry. It's not economic. It's not any, other. It's just military. Ukrainian military must defeat separatists and, Russian troops which are there. They ought to do this. It's not such a bad...
I don't think they disagree, but I don't think they're able to.
They must try.
They can deal with the separatists as we saw it in the summer when they were mostly separatists. But when the Russian troops joined and went in big numbers with serious technical support, then the situation changed, of course.
Yes, of course. But again, I'm not military expert, but they must have to find some solution, just on the battlefield. First of all. Secondly, speaking about Novorossiya or Novorossiya and so on, of course, the very project is dead, as all this, ideological, romantic ideas of the circle of the dreamers who are now supporting, not supporting, but providing Putin with, crazy ideas about Crimea, Novorossiya, and so on. Of course. But the question is, I'm absolutely sure, absolutely agree with Andres. Of course, Poroshenko and Ukrainian, elite authorities and so on, they have several bad choices. But, they're much more lucky and happy than Putin because his choices are, just few. He has just a few choices and all of them are absolutely bad. It's a dead end of his politics, because if he is going on supporting, you know, the idea of Nova Russia, he will face even more serious sanctions from West, which is now actually destroying Russian economy. And that's true. And that's true. It's not. It's serious. It's not jokes. You know?
It's definitely not jokes. Yes. Watching the oil price and the ruble rate in real time.
Not
every
just
day.
About oil price. Look at the financial system of Russia now. It's disastrous. If he will, you know, abandon his support to separatists and so on, he will face a very serious problems inside his, you know, inner circle.
Well, no, because his inner circle, he's not going to face a problem inside his inner circle, because he's only got people in his inner circle who are thinking the same way. It's the people that used to be in his inner circle, or people on the broader elite. That's where he's going to face problems. But if you look at this from what does Putin want? The billion-dollar question. He wants to be able to continue to influence Ukraine. He wants to continue to be able to meddle in the politics of Ukraine. And he'll do that however he can. What I'm wondering is, the maximalist project was this Novorossiya project, right? This seems to be dead. And Andreas, what are your thoughts on that? Where do you think this is going there?
These ideological projects, I think they do have importance for the Russian public discourse, but I don't think they are driving Kremlin policies. Eurasianism, Novorossiya, the Ruski Mir, and so on. I think that Putin and his inner circle are actually not thinking in these terms. They are, with some exceptions like Glazyev, Yakunin, or Rogozin, they are non-ideological people. They want to preserve power, and therefore I don't think that it will be for them a problem to abandon these projects or to reformulate them. But I think they are now sort of developing in the Russian public sphere a life of their own. And if you look at, if you observe people like Igor Girkin, the way he behaves and the status he has now in Russian public discourse, this is becoming worrisome. And it could even turn into a problem for Putin and his inner circle if they do not follow up on this. Mm. So that is all a play with fire and that could get out of control. But still, I think that the contradictions also between the different models, the different nationalist projects, they are so big that I don't think that there is a serious nationalist, ultra-nationalist threat in Russia, because the different nationalisms are not congruent with each other. They are very contradictory. And therefore, I think they will not play as much as a role as many people think.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think they intend to try again to push to Mariupol and to Kharkiv, but just to continue to try to destabilize Ukraine as best they can from where they are?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because the we don't know how the decisions are made, and the circle is very small. They could calculate that a new offensive in Ukraine would be politically beneficial inside Russia for them. But again, then I think the risks are so high with that, with new sanctions perhaps coming from the West and with a much better equipped and much better organized Ukrainian army. I cannot imagine them doing this. But who knows? I mean, these sort of irrational decisions are taken sometimes. So I think they will try to reformulate this whole confrontation with Ukraine and the West in a new way, so as to keep the economy stable to minimize the risks, the economic risks, and that would then mean maybe a long-term road to a settlement of the conflict. Right.
Okay, well, we're just about wrapping up. Last thing, I just want to get Natalia's thoughts on one last thing, and this is, how politically difficult would it be for Poroshenko to actually cede territory? I mean, would that be political suicide, or is that doable and explainable politically?
Well, I think it's going to be really very difficult for him. But I would really want to come back to the question about Putin and the question about Ukraine. In spite of all we've seen in this year and a half, I don't think that Putin is really fixated on Ukraine. I think that Ukraine is just merely an obstacle to his major major aim, is a major goal, is to stay in power and do business with Europe. Because he's been very successful in that. He's been very successful in doing business, not just with Europe as such. That is an obstacle for him, too. European Union is an obstacle for him. So what he really wants is to be able to do business with the individual countries, where Russia becomes a very serious and imposing partner on any of the European countries. So as long as the European Union is an obstacle, he will be fighting with it. He will try to undermine it. But doing business with individual countries, be it Germany, be it Bulgaria, be it any other country, was a very good and successful business for him. So I think that is something that he would like to preserve, but he would get into a bit in a better position, in a better negotiation position with each individual country in Europe.
He was brilliant at doing that until he intervened in Ukraine. I mean, he had that.
That in combination with, well, through Ukraine, he can try to undermine the European Union, the unity of the European Union.
Although he's certainly not succeeded in doing that either, actually.
Well, I mean, it's easier to say in retrospect he didn't know that in the beginning, because at the beginning, we still didn't know what was going to happen. If the European Union would say you were trying your luck with Russia and Russia has valuing our business relations with Russia much more than the Ukrainian territory. Yeah. Bad luck.
But now this had what you'd call an obratny rezultat, as the Russians would say. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's about all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. With me here in the studio has been Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFURL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. And joining us on the Skype line from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Also joining us via Skype from Bonn, Germany, has been Andreas Umland, a professor of Russian and Ukrainian history at Kiev Mohyla Academy and a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kiev. Thanks to all of you for an enlightening discussion. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noise MC.